I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, bitch, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Ted Snyder. He's written for antiwar.com, Consortium News, and other places. This one is very importantly at mondoweiss.net. Netanyahu's latest corruption case could expose long hidden secrets about Israel's nuclear weapons program. Israel has a nuclear weapons program? Welcome to the show, Ted. How are you doing?
I'm good, Scott. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Very happy to have you here. Okay, now we all know they've had A-bombs at least since the 60s. And reportedly, they have H-bombs as well, second strike capability, German-bought submarines, this kind of thing. Everybody knows that, even though supposedly it's a secret, even though American government employees could get in real trouble for admitting that it's true. So, that's the first thing. Israel's got nukes. Right. And secondly, though, dare I get my hopes up that King Benjamin Netanyahu over there, the million-term prime minister of Israel, could really actually possibly be headed out the door from the prime ministership?
I don't know if he will be or not. He's in more trouble than he's been in for a while, both because his coalition is falling apart, but also importantly that there's been three charges against Netanyahu this year, and in all three cases, the Israeli police have recommended indictments. I don't know what will happen, but he faces the threat of indictment, and some of those things, if indictments came up, if they dug, could reveal things in court that could have a bearing on some of those secrets you were talking about at the top of the show.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Well, good. It's always careful what you wish for when it comes to prime ministerships in Israel and that kind of thing. I don't know if I think it's probably pretty clear that Bennett would be worse, but maybe that would be better in the medium term, even to have him worse in the short term and go ahead and help to complete the divorce of liberal Zionists in America from Zionism. For some reason, Netanyahu ain't bad enough, but I think Bennett just might be. But anyway, that aside, I don't even know if Bennett is the most likely replacement or what. But it is good to know, though, that in and of itself, all other things being equal, that Benjamin Netanyahu is in legal trouble here on charges, you say, of bribery and fraud. Now, I have all different kind of examples of Netanyahu's frauds, but I think probably those aren't the ones he's being charged with. So
no,
please
these
do
are,
tell.
These are three very particular cases, and they're interesting not just because of Netanyahu, but they're interesting because of who else they involve. The most recent charge is a charge of bribery and fraud where Netanyahu seemed to be willing to trade regulatory favors to a media outlet in exchange for positive coverage of Netanyahu. And that's the second time he's been charged with that. There was an earlier case where a newspaper that is known for not always giving positive coverage to Netanyahu, was approached by him, and the trade was offered that he would limit the circulation of a competing newspaper, that is, he would help them to do better, if they would provide positive coverage for him. That's interesting because the man that he used to approach the company, the middleman, is a guy named Arnon Milchan. And that's interesting because the third charge against Netanyahu, again, involves Arnon Milchan. And in this case, Netanyahu's been charged with accepting more than $280,000 worth of bribes from Milchan in exchange for giving him tax help, but more importantly for our story, In exchange for intervening with the U.S. to try to get him a long-term visa in the United States, Netanyahu went so far to help Milchin get this long-term visa. It went to such high levels that he reportedly approached then-Secretary of State John Kerry three times to ask Kerry to intervene for Milchin. So what's interesting for me in these charges against Netanyahu is that two of them involve this mysterious guy named Arnon Milchin, and he's sort of the centerpiece of my story.
All right, well, I guess let me just say right here before I forget for later. It seems kind of strange, doesn't it, that Netanyahu would still be palling around with this guy and, in fact, even committing crimes with him when they ought to be pretending that they've never met and don't know each other for the rest of their lives because of the stuff that you're talking about, this secret history buried here.
So let me tell you a little bit about Arnon Milchin, because most people who are listening to the show, if they know Arnon Milchin, they know him as a Hollywood celebrity. Arnon Milchin was, or is, an Israeli billionaire who's a Hollywood producer of more than like 150 movies, and not like small, you know, you've never heard of this guy's movies. Arnon Milchin was the producer of 12 Years a Slave, of Birdman, Brazil, Pretty Woman. He produced big movies, and he lived the life of a celebrity in the United States. But in the shadows of this celebrity life, Milchin was living a very separate, secret life, because he was an Israeli spy. He was working for Israeli intelligence in America, and what he was doing was setting up front companies that raised money to finance Israel's clandestine nuclear program. And Milchin had always enjoyed these 10-year U.S. visas so he could stay resident in Hollywood and produce movies. The reason he needed Netanyahu's help in staying in the States is because Milchin admitted that he was an Israeli spy on American soil, and he lost his right to get these automatic renewals. So he went to Netanyahu to plead for help to keep him in the U.S. So Milchin's actually this behind the Hollywood producer is this, he considered himself a very James Bondy character, where he went around the world setting up front companies, raising money and financing this diamond of the secret Israeli nuclear program. So that's the story behind Milchin. This is the guy that worked as the middleman for Netanyahu in one case he's charged at, and this is the guy that was involved in the briber case. So two of the three cases involve Arnon Milchin. That's what got me interested, is when I first read this charge against Netanyahu and I saw it was Arnon Milchin, and I remembered reading that name. I knew Arnon Milchin. And I went back and started digging into the history of Arnon Milchin. And as I dug further and further into the story got more and more crazily intriguing. Do you want me to go on, or do you have a particular question? Or do you want me to tell you how it starts getting intriguing?
Well, I did have one small question here, which was, was the context of his admission of being an Israeli spy?
He was giving an interview, and in the interview, he came straight out and said it. And then afterwards, Shimon Peres, who had been a prime minister, I think at the time he was president when he said this, Peres confirmed that he was the guy that recruited Milchin into Israeli intelligence way back in the 60s. So Milchin admitted it. When he admitted it, he lost his right to visas. Peres confirmed it. Peres had hired Milchin in the 60s into this organization with the Hebrew acronym LAKAM, L-A-K-A-M. This is so secret in Israel that they operate even in the shadows of Israeli intelligence. They don't report to Israeli intelligence chiefs. They report directly to the Minister of Defense. LAKAM has two jobs. Their job was to hide the true intention of the Dimona nuclear plant from U.S. intelligence. So their job was to keep the Israeli program secret from America. And their second job, and this is where Milchin comes in, was to go around the world stealing scientific intelligence from Israel's allies that Israel could then use in developing its nuclear program. So this is admitted by Milchin, confirmed by Shimon Peres. We know what he was doing. We know everything. When you just research this, though, it kind of stays there. It's when you start looking for links between Milchin and Netanyahu that it gets interesting. And the really crazy thing, Scott, is if you look up like Milchin Netanyahu, like if you Google that or something, nothing comes up. There's nothing. You have to dig and sort of sideways.
Not even my interviews of Grant Smith?
Pardon?
Not even my interviews of Grant Smith? I guess it didn't necessarily make the show notes, the proper name there.
I mean, Grant's one of the two researchers that have done the most work on this. And as I dug deeper and deeper, I'm on this like crazy detective story and I'm going, it's going all. And, you know, when I got to the end, I realized there's actually a couple of guys that had already gotten there. Grant Smith and Roger Mattson, which was cool for me because I got to talk to both of them doing this article. And I got to bounce it off them, see what they thought, see how far you could take it. Where it really gets interesting, Scott, is in this case that came up in the 1980s. Where American customs realized that there was a smuggling operation where these things called Crichtons were being smuggled out of the States. Crichtons are high-speed switches that can be used in medical equipment, but here's where it gets interesting. They're dual use. They can also be used in a nuclear program. They can be used for nuclear weapons. And so you're not allowed to export Crichtons out of the United States without a State Department munitions license. You can't export them because they're nuclear equipment. So what happened in the 1980s is that Israel needed Crichtons for their nuclear program. And this company operating out of California called Milco International, which is owned and operated by this guy named Richard Kelly Smythe, starts smuggling Crichtons out of the States into Israel. Richard Kelly Smythe is an American physicist. He's a consultant for NATO. He has high-level security. He knows about Crichtons. He knows where to get them. And in the early 1980s, his company, Milco, smuggles 15 separate orders with a total of over 800 Crichtons out of the United States and delivers them to the Israeli Ministry of Defense. Okay, so the U.S. Customs catches on to this. They charge Smythe. Smythe disappears forever. They finally find him in Spain, I think it was, and they charge him. And in 2001, Smythe pleads guilty to violating Arms Export Controls Acts. He gets sentenced to 40 years in jail. Because later they consider him to be old and a health risk, he actually only serves 4 of those years. But he's found guilty.
And that's amazing to me. When I read that in your piece, I actually had to stop and go, wait, did I misread that? The U.S. Department of Justice mercilessly prosecuted someone for violating the Export Arms Control Act in the case of providing nuclear equipment or nuclear technology to Israel. I mean, that is incredible. Seems like politics would have intervened and prevented that from even getting to the grand jury.
And it seems like in other cases it did, but in this one, for whatever reason, it didn't. And what's really interesting and where the detective work gets cool is while they're going after Richard Kelly Smythe, the FBI interrogates him. And there's an extensive memorandum that Grant Smith, the researcher you mentioned earlier, managed to get through a Freedom of Information Act. It's heavily redacted, but it's completely clear from the text that it's an FBI interview with Richard Kelly Smythe. And what's cool is that Smythe is smuggling these Crichtons out of the United States into Israel. And what becomes clear from the memos is that his Israeli collaborator on the smuggling operation is a young Benjamin Netanyahu. The FBI memorandum clearly says that Smythe and Netanyahu met frequently in restaurants in Tel Aviv. They met in Netanyahu's home. Netanyahu was a collaborator on this, but that's interesting. But what gets huger when you consider these Arnon Milchin cases is that the company Milco that Richard Kelly Smythe started up, it's a front company. It's not real. It's real, but it's not its independent company. It's a front company started up by Arnon Milchin. Arnon Milchin was a business associate of Smythe. He pressures Smythe to start up this company, and there's a profit-sharing deal. Milchin gets 60% of the Triton sales, and Smythe gets 40%. So it's a 40-60 profit-sharing. And Milco, the company smuggling these Crichtons out of the U.S., is actually a front company for Milchin. So when Netanyahu is dealing with Milco, he's actually dealing with Milchin, who he's now in court with. But Scott, it gets even worse for Netanyahu because the link is way more direct. It's not just that Netanyahu was dealing with Smythe and Smythe happened to be working for Arnon Milchan, what actually happened is that the Israeli Ministry of Defense had gone to this Israeli company called Heli Trading Company, and the Israeli Ministry of Defense gave Heli, Ministry of Defense, money and told them to use that money to get these nuclear parts, these Krytons. So Heli takes this Ministry of Defense money and they go to Milko Company, Smythe's company, and they tell Smythe's company to smuggle the Krytons out. But here's where it gets interesting. At the time that Heli Company is working with Milko, Benjamin Netanyahu is an employee of Heli Company. So when Netanyahu is meeting with Richard Kelly Smythe, he's meeting with him on behalf of Heli Corporation. He's working on behalf of Heli Corporation to smuggle U.S. nuclear equipment illegally out of the United States into Israel for a secret nuclear program. And as if that's not bad enough, when you look at this FBI memorandum that Grant Smith got, the FBI memorandum makes it clear that Heli Company is actually Milchan, that Milchan owns Heli Company. So when Netanyahu is meeting with Smythe to smuggle nuclear parts illegally into Israel, he's working under the employ of Arnon Milchan. So Netanyahu was actually working. He was actually an employee of Milchan, smuggling illegally parts of the United States into Israel's nuclear weapons program. So Netanyahu was under employ. And that's what he was doing when he was meeting Milchan, is he was doing this operation. And now that he's been charged with these dealings with Milchan and it comes to Israeli courts, I think what's potentially dangerous about this isn't just that Netanyahu's government could be in trouble, but if the courts probe this Netanyahu-Milchan link, what could come out publicly in an Israeli court is not only a public court declaration that there actually is a nuclear weapons program in Israel, but perhaps more dangerously for the states, that the U.S. knew it all along and actually knew that weapons program was partly built by stealing equipment from the states and smuggling it into Israel. And that's, I think, the huge danger of this court case that no one's covering in the press. I mean, in the press, they talk about the court case and you occasionally get mention of the Smythe Netanyahu stuff, but nobody talks about this guy that Netanyahu's being charged with, this guy he's collaborating with. He was actually collaborating with in the 80s to build an Israeli nuclear program by stealing equipment from the U.S. and smuggling it into Israel. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the potential explosiveness of these court cases.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know, what the potential actually is. I mean, I don't guess you're really saying you know exactly what the potential is that this kind of thing could, be developed further in court there. It may not be directly germane to whatever they're fighting about, or maybe the judge would decide that it is, and so they'll talk about it. Who knows? I don't know. But certainly it brings up just the fact that these men's names are being discussed together. It means that, Ynet, Jerusalem Post, Haaretz, they should all be running articles about this.
Right.
This should be getting major international news. This should be getting attention, in Europe. And, of course, there's going to be a blackout here almost entirely. Maybe something right at The Intercept or something, it's good to see you writing this thing for Mondo Weiss. That's for sure.
Yeah, there's been the press is covering the charges. They're mentioning the name Arnon Milchan. Sometimes in the context, you'll see something about this Krytron case come up, but the link between that this link between Netanyahu and Arnon Milchan isn't something new. The historical link that they were actually that Netanyahu was his employee in the smuggling of parts, this doesn't come up in the media coverage of these cases at all. It's been completely hushed. Nobody talks about it. It's a potentially huge story that's just being buried.
Yeah. Well, of course, Grant wrote the book Divert about NUMEC and the Israeli theft of weapons-grade uranium in the U.S. during the Lyndon Johnson administration years.
So Grant wrote the book NUMEC, and Roger Mattson also has written an amazing book on the same thing called, he called it Stealing the Atom Bomb, How Denial and Deception Armed Israel. And both of them, in Mattson's book, he talks about Arnon Milchan, and he talks about the Krytrons case. It's really hard to get beyond that and find the heli company stuff and the link between Netanyahu and Milchin. If you look up like Netanyahu and Milchin, you don't find much. It's not until you see in the FBI memorandum that Netanyahu was an employee of heli company, and then you start doing research on Netanyahu and heli. So if you do like Netanyahu Milchin, it's really hard to find anything. If you do Netanyahu heli, then all of a sudden you start to find stuff. But you've got to first realize that when Netanyahu was meeting with Smythe, he was actually meeting with him in the capacity of an employee of Arnon Milchin's, that his job was to, you know, that Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel in an earlier incarnation, seems like he was a nuclear parts smuggler to steal from the states to start building up this illegal Israeli nuclear program. It's an astonishing story. It's an incredible story.
Hey guys, here's how to help support the show. First of all, buy my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Everybody likes it. It's got great reviews. Read the paperback, the Kindle, or the audiobook, and the EPUB is available at Barnes & Noble and everywhere else online as well. Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. And also, I take donations. If you go to scotthorton.org/donate, you'll see the kickbacks. You can get a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think audiobooks, or a silver commodity disc for any donation of $100. And you get a signed copy of Fool's Errand for $50. So that ain't too bad. And anyone who donates by way of PayPal or patreon.com/ScottHortonShow, $5 or more per month, and you'll get access to the private subreddit, the new Reddit group there at r/ScottHortonShow. And all new signers, uppers to Patreon also get 2 free audiobooks as well. And yes, I take every kind of cryptocurrency, most especially Horizon, but also Bitcoin and the rest of them too. So check all that out at scotthorton.org/donate and patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. Thanks. Oh yeah, and don't forget to shop amazon.com by way of my link at the bottom of my page at scotthorton.org. You'll see it there. Well, and of course, one of the most interesting parts of all of this is the fact that they've had nukes since the 60s and that the U.S. government has gone along with this whole idea that, well, but we won't be the first to introduce them in the Middle East, where introduce is defined all the way down to the most literal context, that they are not going to bring the nukes to dinner over at the Saudi king's house and introduce them. But yeah. Otherwise, yeah, they'll be the first to have them and make sure that everybody knows that they have them. But right. And then that puts them, that puts really, you know, U.S. aid to Israel in violation of the law, where if they have undeclared nuclear weapons and they're, you know, they're not declared and a member of the NPT and all of that, then they're not supposed to get any kind of cooperation from the U.S. until they're in compliance with all that.
Right. And under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, a nuclear power can't assist a non-nuclear power in developing a nuclear weapon. So, you know, if it were to come out that the U.S. knew all along that right. Israel was developing it, and that in fact they were developing it partly by stealing American equipment in this case, or in the NUMEC case, which is, I think, a much bigger case, actually stealing, you know, uranium to get a nuclear program going, These have potentially large ramifications for the states. I'm not saying anything will come of it, right? But what's right. what's interesting is that it, you know, to read the media today, you just see that Netanyahu's been charged, and he was involved in a bribery case with this guy named Arnon Milchin, and the newspapers kind of leave it at that. And it's not till you start digging that you realize that Netanyahu and Milchin have this long history, and that the history includes, you know, the Prime Minister of Israel was involved in illegally smuggling nuclear parts into Israel to develop a clandestine nuclear weapons program. And that should be all over the press when they link Netanyahu to Milchin, and nobody's doing anything in these cases with linking Netanyahu to Milchin. So it would be really interesting if in the case, in looking at the fact that Netanyahu used Milchin as a middleman in the bribery case, that, you know, in the past Milchin had used Netanyahu as a middleman in a nuclear case, is a huge story that I hope could mm-hmm. come from this.
And now, when you say nobody, you're including Israeli media there too?
You know, I obviously haven't read everything. When you look into the stories as they're covered in the BBC or the New York Times or the Guardian, you look at any sort of the large
It'd be interesting
papers,
to see if there's anything at the linked. Jerusalem Post or Ynet.
The ones that I've looked at, you know, in English, I'm not seeing it. I don't read Hebrew. I don't know what's in the, if you do a search for it, nothing comes up. Like if you do a search for Netanyahu, Arnon Milchan, really little comes up. When you go around it and you type something else in, like Netanyahu Heli Trading Company, then you start to get to stuff. But the linchpin in all of this is the FBI memorandum that Grant Smith got released. Like if without that FBI memorandum that says two things, it says three things really, that Netanyahu met with Smythe, that Netanyahu worked with Heli, and then it actually says that Heli and Milchan are the same company. When I ran that by Grant Smith, he said they're not actually the same company, but they're both owned by Milchan. But it's the FBI memorandum that makes the link between Netanyahu and Smythe, Netanyahu and Heli, Netanyahu and Milchan. Without that FBI memorandum, you'd have nothing. Like you can't find anything until you find that. It's a well-kept secret.
Yeah. It's amazing too, isn't it, about just the extent of media silence on something like this. Like out of all the newspaper editors of all the major papers in the U.S., which there are at least, you know, a solid dozen, maybe even two dozen that would count, you know, throw in the Toledo Blade. I don't know. And none of them had the courage to publish this thing.
No, you're not seeing much of this. You're not seeing much at all. And when the autobiography Confidential came out, the story of, you know, Milchan, where he, in this interview, he said he was a spy. Even when that book came out, you know, Netanyahu and Peres asked, you know, Milchan to be silent on this. They didn't want anybody commenting on this. Like this part of history is being deeply hushed. And it's being deeply hushed, of course, because when you scratch the story, you get illegally stealing U.S. nuclear parts for a secret Israeli program. And if that comes out, you know, that explodes a lot of stuff.
Right. By the way, speaking of Mondo Weiss and really of the larger context here, there's a story that came out today. Adam Horowitz, not the Beastie Boy, but the Mondo Weiss guy, is here at this morning. Groundbreaking poll. American support for one Democratic state equal to support for two-state solution. And then support for the status quo occupation or outright annexation and apartheid is extremely low, 8 and 11% respectively, while 35 and 36% are split on whether equal rights for everyone under, who are obviously de facto already annexed anyway, the Palestinians living under the jurisdiction of the Israeli government, or go ahead and let them have independence. But you know, prevent it from being this way anymore. And that to me is absolutely astounding, considering, you know, the prevalent media narratives about Israel, where whatever they're doing is always in retaliation. It's always in defense from the, you know, dark hordes of Mordor that they're protecting themselves from or whatever kind of garbage. And the fact that people see through that so well is, and I guess it was the way the question was phrased too. So the occupation's been going on since 67. So what are we going to do, this or that? So maybe that's a little bit rigged. But no, I mean, they did leave the option of keep things the way they are. And people rejected that soundly. So it's real progress. And, you know, it's stories like this where people find out things like this and can't really believe the depth of corruption here, the depth of influence that a foreign country has over this one, especially one the size of Maryland, over USA, number one superpower of all time. You know?
I mean, I haven't read that story yet in Mondo Weiss, but that American perceptions of what's going on in Israel has been shifting over the years, I think is clear. And also that, you know, that American government policy doesn't match always what happens when you ask people in the States what they want is also, you know, an old trend too. So I haven't read that story yet, but it doesn't surprise me. It fits the trend.
Right. So, and then I guess I have to say just to you, because this will be old news by the time anybody hears it probably on this show, but It looks like the Senate is about to pass this Yemen war resolution. They've just rejected a Tom Cotton amendment that would make an exception for when the Houthis attack outside of Yemen. Then we have the right. And apparently they saw right through that, that was a loophole for, you know, continuing to back the Saudi side of the war, seen as a loophole maybe for providing a new authorization. It was the kind of thing that was couched in a way to sound pretty acceptable and yet was pretty soundly defeated just now as an amendment to this thing. So anyway, and I think we both know that this is not going to end the war itself. The House, you know, the Democrats are going along. Five Democrats infamously helped the Republicans kill it in the House yesterday. But it, you know, even if it's not everything, even if it came down to him, you know, Trump vetoing the thing and then failing to override it or something like that, ultimately, it's the fact of the argument, the fact that the Senate is doing it, the fact that this pressure exists, I think quite possibly could force Trump's hand, or, you know, quote unquote, force Trump's hand to really end this thing. I mean, after all, just about a month ago, Pompeo, and I guess Mattis both said, yeah, let's give it about 30 days and wrap this thing up. And it was because of this kind of pressure coming from the people and from the Senate. And so anyway, I'm trying to be optimistic about this thing because, of course, Yemen is the very worst thing that America is doing right now. So,
yeah, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. But, and all in the ridiculous idea that this is somehow, you know, part of the keeping of Iran in check, which has been known from the beginning to be absolute nonsense.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? Let me ask you something. You're such an astute observer of all of this stuff, and I do hope that everyone will read your great archive at antiwar.com and wherever else. But so I guess, and you know, I oversimplify things sometimes, maybe for narrative's sake. But I was talking with Andrew Bacevich about this, and he was saying he disagreed with me and said he thinks everything is much more chaotic and much more stupid. Essentially, that. Not the people, but the plan that nobody really in the foreign policy community, they really don't know what they're doing. They're playing whack-a-mole. They're fighting last year's war. They're lost. They're, you know, they really don't think as hard about what to do as you and I do about what they do, kind of idea. But so my kind of whole sort of analysis of the last time is that Bush really made what they all now consider a huge mistake in empowering the Shiite supermajority in Iraq and displacing the Sunni minority regime there. And ever since, like 2006 or 7, still during the Bush years, they did, you know, the famous Hirsch article, the redirection, where they put Elliot Abrams and others in charge of kind of realigning the policy to remind everyone that even though we just fought a war, we're right in the middle of fighting a war for Iran, that actually we hate them and we wish we hadn't done that, and we're tilting back toward the Saudi king as hard as we can. And that's when they started backing Jandallah and Iran and Muslim Brotherhood groups in Syria, Fatah al-Islam, at least for a little while there. I don't know how long that lasted in Lebanon. And I know you know that part of the story. But so I guess my idea is that basically, Bush screwed up and empowered the Shia, and ever since then, they've been trying to make up for that. That is the overriding, you know, grand strategy in the Middle East, is they keep spiting themselves in the name of spiting Iran. So, for another example, we can't give Baghdad back to the Sunnis, but we can at least take Damascus away from the Shia and the, you know, the Alawites and this regime that's allied with Iran. As Obama said to Goldberg, yeah, this is a great way to take Iran down a peg, is by getting rid of Assad. I mean, he said that in The Atlantic. But of course, by the end of the thing, Iran has a more powerful foothold in Syria than ever before because of how necessary they were to come and help save the Syrian state from America's CIA Al-Qaeda terrorists. So, just like in Iraq, they thought they were going to have more power and more leverage over Iran, and in fact, it ended up the opposite. And then they've repeated that same error, in a sense, in Syria, and then with Iraq War III against Islamic State, even more so. So, in other words, they're driving themselves into this crazed frustration that everything they do makes Iran more and more powerful. Iraq War II, Iraq War III, Syria, and then in this case, in Yemen, as you said, they launched the war in the name of stopping Iran. And if anything, Iran has, you know, scored a major victory here without even extending much effort, just because the Americans and the Saudis give them all the credit for everything that the Houthis do. So they don't even have to really lift a finger, and they get credit for winning this war that America's losing, and Saudi is losing. And so anyway, that's what I think. But obviously, it's a little bit oversimplified talking about, you know, decades at a time here. But what do you think?
I don't know what Andrew Bezos is. I mean, I don't think that's totally wrong. And I think that the states made a lot of moves without understanding what was happening on the ground. And with Iran as the enemy, accidentally kept making Iran more and more powerful, with Iran not actually doing anything or even seeking this. I think that, you know, Iran, in the case of Yemen, they were only very tangentially related at all. The Iranians didn't really have any influence over the Houthi. In fact, the Iranians asked the Houthi specifically not to go into the capital city. And we saw how much influence they had, because the Houthi did anyway. But, you know, Iran never had much influence there. The claim that Iran was smuggling weapons into Yemen, Gareth Porter has, you know, really clearly shown that none of that was true. So you take a country that's not involved in Yemen at all, you walk out, and, you know, they have more influence. Same thing happens in Syria and Iraq, where, you know, in Iraq you get a party who says that they'll give up their weapons if they can become a political party, and you end up with political parties in charge that are more allied to Iran in the first place. But Scott, the real thing for me, like the thing that's tragic about this for me, is that all of this is being done in the name of stopping Iran, and you know, stopping Iran from what? Because every intelligence community always knew that Iran wasn't developing a nuclear weapon, that it's not Iran that's the country that's backing terrorism in the Middle East. And so all of this is so ridiculously avoidable, because it's all in the name of stopping Iran from doing something that everybody in American intelligence knows that Iran was never doing in the first place. Yeah. So it's just so ridiculously avoidable.
You know, I interviewed a State Department guy named Wayne White back. It was at the beginning of 07, when everybody was afraid, when they were launching the surge, people were really worried that Bush and Cheney were going to attack Iran right then. They started the whole new propaganda campaign about the EFPs and blaming Iran for everything wrong in Iraq. And I'm pretty sure it was Wayne White, when I interviewed him at the time, who said that, you know, essentially there's this grudge. Oh, in fact, Mark Perry, who I'm going to interview later today, I'm pretty sure has told me this too, that inside the government, inside the State Department especially, but throughout the Pentagon and whatever, that they just cannot and will not ever get over the hostage crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, never mind what America's ever done to Iran. That ain't got nothing right to do with it. They took hostages, and to the American establishment, that's like that time they got tortured in Abu Ghraib. They want revenge, and they'll never give it up. After all these years, they can't just say, you know, the old dead Ayatollah died in 89. We've had the much nicer, more deal withable Ayatollah since then. Give me a break, you know?
You know, this is like, I've written about this in other pieces, where I've called this historical amnesia or history ex nihilo, like history that comes from nowhere, that in the American narrative, the conflict with Iran starts with the hostage taking in 1979. And one of the great sort of tricks in history is where you start your story. And sure, if you start your story with the hostage taking 1979, then you've got this evil story. But if you look at what led up to 1979, why they took the hostages, and I'm not justifying hostage taking, you know, I'm a pacifist, I'm not justifying any kind of violence at all. But if you look at the history prior to 1979, from the taking out of the Shah, and then the taking out of the Mossadegh and the putting of the Shah, and then, you know, the fear in 1979 when the Shah was deposed and the Americans took him into the States again, and this fear that, oh no, you're going to protect the Shah and put him back in, and a whole bunch of other stuff that was going on at the time, where they were really afraid that the Americans were going to midwife another another coup. If you start the story in 53 or whatever it was, with the CIA coup, they've admitted it was a coup against Mossadegh. It changes everything. But yeah, if you start in 79, if you arbitrarily start your history there, then you get this American obsession. But that's not even the right place to start the history. So it's not only that all this could be avoidable because Iran was never going after a nuclear weapon, and Iran was never, you know, being the leading state sponsor of terrorism. Even the state's own intelligence documents say Iran's not the leading state sponsor of terrorism. And you go back before 79, you start the story in the right place. So you're fighting Iran over nothing, and you're starting your narrative that justifies fighting Iran in totally the wrong place. The slightest bit of careful history and so much of this horror, like the horror in Yemen, could just be totally avoided.
Yeah, it is really crazy. And, you know, it's funny, too, that to me, it's just the biggest practical joke in the world on America that you have, and in the world, really, but especially on us, that you have a right-wing Republican who's, I guess, emotional enough that, and from just a separate clique enough, I guess, of power, that he's just not invested in the Bush terror war era, really, who kind of detests it, who has said, you know, not quite correctly, but, you know, greatly, he said that Bush's decision to invade Iraq, to invade the Middle East, as he put it, to start this whole project, was the worst mistake in American history any president has ever made, which that goes to show how ignorant he is of American history. But still, he's right that it's that bad, right? And so, and yet at the same time, this same guy I'm talking about, this same president, is the biggest boob idiot in the world with no conviction, no strength. He's a bigger wimp than his predecessor, even when it comes to rolling over for the generals who say that this has to continue when he doesn't believe in it at all, just like his predecessor, knows better, and still does it anyway. I think Obama could at least rationalize it in a way where Trump, he only rationalizes his own fortune is at stake, that he can't, he needs these generals to still tell Americans that he's all right or he has no chance at re-election. So that's it for him.
Yeah. And, yeah. I did a piece earlier for Anti-War on I forget what it was called, when all you have is bullying or something like that, where really Trump's foreign policy and this really, all of it just comes down to bullying, and that the world is starting to adjust in the way that they, with the way that they deal with that bullying. But you have a White House that seems to be all over the place in its foreign policy, that there's infighting, a total lack of understanding. And it really just comes down to the few things that Trump really wants to happen. And go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? Your audio cut out for just a sec, so I thought you stopped. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's okay. No, it's okay. That all you've got is this foreign policy that's in total disarray, that's just based on the few things that Trump doesn't want to get pushed around on and digs in and bullies other people to get its way. And you've got a foreign policy that seems to be based much more on bullying than a foreign policy that's based on even close to a sophisticated understanding of history or what's happening in the world.
Well, you know, I've had Trump fans say to me, and you know what, this is kind of Obama bot thinking, no doubt, but I'll still try it out on you, that actually, you know what, Trump ain't that dumb of a dummy, and that really this is all deliberate, that there's no real gentle way to withdraw from NATO. So the best thing to do is just go over there and insult the Europeans in every way, call them obsolete. He's never really called for abolishing NATO or called for American withdrawal from NATO, but they are now having serious discussions about creating a European army. And so then the idea would be that he's playing, it's just two-dimensional chess, but it's chess, man. He's trying to get everybody, he wants the multipolar world that's coming. He wants the decline of American overextended hegemony that is just unaffordable from even a Fox News fan's point of view. And he wants retrenchment, but he needs reactions against him and his oafishness as the great catalyst for helping make all this happen. Did the Japanese really want to stake all their fortunes on an America run by a Donald Trump, or might they prefer to figure out a way to go it alone and take care of themselves, and that so therefore give the man a little bit of credit. He does know what he's doing. He's trying to push everyone away from America so that he has a better excuse to retrench later or in effect in the next administration or something. What do you think of that?
I think the fear with that, you know, use the metaphor of the chess game, and I think the fear of that is that it's looking one move ahead and it's not looking farther ahead in the game, in the sense that if you, that these things may work on particular policy But if you put them in the context of overall U.S. foreign policy, I think the last piece I did for Antiwar was called, Rogue
America. Hey, by the way, man, I'm sorry to interrupt. You can go back to this in just 1 second. But breaking news, it passed 58-41 so far.
Okay.
In the U.S. Senate, invoking the War Powers Act. That's historical, man. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. I didn't think that would ever happen.
Yeah.
As Bernie Sanders and Mike Lee, the socialist and the libertarian type.
Yeah.
Leading it too from the two parties. I'm sorry. Please go ahead with what you're saying. But no, I was going to say,
if you look at his individual policies, that argument might hold some water. But if you look at American foreign policy post World War II, and you look at what's the sort of overarching goal of American foreign policy, and I think in some ways it can be really simply put as keep Europe away from Russia and keep Russia away from China. Like Kissinger said, the worst thing that could ever happen is Russia and China unite. And the whole sort of post-NATO thing has been keep Europe in NATO. Don't let Europe go to Russia. So if you look at American foreign policy, it's a simplistic way of saying it. But I put it as keep Europe from Russia, keep Russia from China. But when Trump does this bullying, what he's really doing is he's pushing Europe more and more to Russia. He's pushing Europe to Russia on the whole Iran thing, where Europe says, you know, we're going to go around you, we're going to deal with Iran. So he's pushing Europe more and more to Russia, and he's pushing Russia more and more to China, the whole Shanghai cooperative. So this kind of bullying approach where he pushes everyone away might seem like Trump knows what he's doing, but in the larger context of overall U.S. foreign policy, he's completely blowing the two overarching foreign policy goals, which is pushing the NATO countries to Russia instead of to America, and then pushing that group to China and building this massive bloc that opposes America in the world. So I think you can look at Trump stuff individually and argue whether it's successful or not. But I think if you look at it in the larger context of American foreign policy, he's losing the game. It's a long-term disaster, I think. And that's why in my piece, I talk about my other piece, I was talking about the Rogue one, where you see America wants to be a hegemon, but what countries do when they're a power like a hegemon is that they lead the world. But Trump's not leading the world. He's pushing the world away and going off on his own. And that's causing the world to form alliances that could be very threatening to any kind of American hegemony later on. But that's a different article from the Netanyahu one, right?
Yeah. Well, you know me. I'm off on a tangent. These things happen. But here's to the demise of, the imprisonment of Benjamin Netanyahu. I won't hold my breath. But you know what?
Right.
They do jail prime ministers over there and presidents, too. So they have something that... You know, kind of accountability for politically powerful people that is unheard of in America, really.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out. But the connections that these cases reveal are you know, historically intriguing.
Absolutely. So, okay. Well, everyone, please go and read Ted. You can find click more viewpoints. It's a week or two old now or something. Click more viewpoints on antiwar.com. You'll find it there. It's also, and the link is to MondoWeiss.net. MondoWeiss.net. Netanyahu's latest corruption case could expose long hidden secrets about Israel's nuclear weapons program. Thanks again, Ted.
Thanks, Scott.
Appreciate it. All right, y'all. Thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh, yeah. And read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.